Johnny seldom attended their conferences, but they often rushed dispatch boxes to him to get his opinion on something. As they often told each other, anti-war was the most profitable venture they had ever heard of. The Hoven Commercial Intelligence Service circulated a secret report on the 28 platforms without knowing it had been planted on them by the Galactic Bank. They had been chosen for the leak because they were the most infiltrated intelligence service in any universe. The report was rapidly and secretly relayed all over the galaxies. It alleged that the original 28 had been increased to 53 to allow for new nations, and that the platforms were actually located in the 17th universe. The report created a new flurry of anti-war. But it also created astrographic turmoil, as it upset the stable datum that, as the number 4, when squared, made 16, there could only be 16 universes. Immediate action resulted. Several scientific bodies began searching, not necessarily to find the firing platforms, but to see whether there was a 17th universe. The Democratic Royal Institute of Chataveria did find an additional universe, but since it was just forming and had no evidence of sentient life in it, and since there was no trace of anything to put platforms on, it concluded it must be the 18th universe. The 17th universe containing the platforms remains undiscovered to this day. And, as Johnny sometimes told himself, this was not hard to understand. It was in his head. He never built the platforms. McAdam had told Johnny that quite a few of the old Intergalactic Mining Company reserve planets, even though habitable and currently uninhabited, were a drag on the market. So Johnny, by special Salachi couriers from his own staff, secretly informed the original emissaries of different groups of planets on the list. They promptly made deals with the company and then rushed the planets into the real estate market with the slogan, "Enjoy peaceful, untargeted suburban living." And they made even vaster fortunes for themselves and their friends. They swore by Johnny. Peace was one of the most profitable discoveries ever made. During that period, the only sour bit of news that came Johnny's way was brought to him by his accounts staff. It had increased to 200 Salachis to keep track of his income. They told him that the Earth Division of Build Strong Incorporated was now the only company he had that was running in the red. All the rest were way up in the black. Johnny said he'd have a word with its general manager, and he did. He found that they had added to their payroll another 200,000 Chataverian workers. The general manager explained they were not just building the burned Earth cities now, but had branched out and were rebuilding all the others, and had a 200-year construction program they had all planned out and didn't want interrupted. Johnny told him and his 6 assistant general managers that he was building cities for which no populations existed nor would exist in the next several centuries, and that they better start figuring out how to show a profit. They said they would, but in return he insisted they keep on with their program. No, they didn't have any plans to settle Earth with Chataverians. They knew that would engulf man. It was just that when they got going doing something, they built up an awfully big momentum. Johnny thought it didn't much matter anyway, so he forgot about it. Sometime after that, Stormalong got bored with demonstrating the new teleportation-motored atmosphere transports Desperation Defense was selling all over the galaxies and training pilots for, and he talked Johnny into letting him rehabilitate an old company orbit miner with cranes and fly to the moon. Johnny talked Stormalong into first getting some pressure suits and then getting 3 other pilots as crazy as Stormalong, refitting 4 orbit miners and doing it right. Stormalong had the excuse that he wanted to go see whether he could find some more of that heavy metal. He figured that flights of meteorites had now hit the moon. It took them 2 months to get ready and to make the trip and return. They found the meteorites with heavy metal traces, all right, and mined them, and brought back about 200 tons of ore to process. But Stormalong brought back startling news. "There's footprints up there," he told Johnny, "and tire treads." This being in the world of tracking, Johnny was very interested. They speculated on the possibility they had invaders, but the Desperation Defense people poo-pooed it. Nothing could get through their defenses. They then wondered if it might not have been the visitors putting down there during the war. Johnny wasn't going to spend weeks in space in an orbit miner, so he chartered Dry's Glotten's space yacht for a weekend, and he and Stormalong were taken up to have another look. Yes, sir. Footprints. Tire treads. Then the sharp-trained eye of Johnny spotted a paper wrapper that must have been discarded and lay almost covered with dust. It said, Carefree Sugarless Gum, Spearmint, 15 Sticks, Lifesavers Incorporated, New York City. Stormalong thought it must be some salvage gear from a wreck, maybe. But there was no wreck. Dries thought that maybe it was used to repair holes. Gum, you know. Johnny wouldn't let them mess up the tracks with their own. He picto-recorded them, and then backtracked them and found a cairn with the very faded remains of what might have been a flag. Then, although he had trouble walking with almost no weight, he hiked around and found another cairn with another flag in it, also faded beyond recognition. That was all they found. But Johnny showed them that the exposed edge of the wrapper was much more faded than the buried part, and from that he deducted that these tracks and cairns were hundreds of years old. So they decided it was not an immediate danger and started back home. The real discovery was made on the way back. Johnny was admiring Dries's communication gear, and Dries showed him the first pictures he had taken of the planet, and Johnny noticed there seemed to be much more cloud cover now. He did more comparisons. They were flashing down toward Europe, of course, but they could still see northern Africa and the Middle East. The latter was green, and the former had a new sea in the middle of it. Landed again, even though he was late for Sunday night supper, Johnny got right on to the Desperation Defense duty officer and wanted to know if he was aware of planetary changes. He was, and referred Johnny to the general manager of Buildstrong.
You ordered us to show a profit, the general manager said defensively, so we hired some more Chataverians and started a health subsidiary. We figured Buildstrong could also be interpreted to mean strong bodies.
Johnny wanted to know what the devil he had done now. And it seemed there was a below-sea-level spot in the dry wasteland of the Sahara Desert, so they let the Mediterranean in and made a new sea that would furnish rainfall. And they had machine-gun planted 85 quadrillion trees there, and also in the Middle East, where they wouldn't require much water. Good varieties, slow-growing, but very tasty. And they'd planted another 16 quadrillion in the Middle West of the American continent. Oh, Johnny hadn't seen that part of the continent? Well, there used to be trees on that huge central flat plain. They could prove it by fossil remains. Anyway, he was sorry if it had changed the climate, but it usually did, you know. Cleaned up the air, too. Johnny wanted to know how spending that much money and hiring that new army of Chataverians was going to make a profit. And the general manager showed him the balance sheets now. They were all in the black. They were exporting food trees to food-short Chataverian planets. Johnny forgave him, raised his pay, and went home to a very late Sunday dinner. Another incident worthy of note happened about that time. Johnny, wearing an extraterrestrial atmosphere mask to keep from being stopped on the street and gathering crowds, attended a fair in Zurich, and there he saw Pierre Solon. The ex-pilot was in beggar's rags and holding forth to an audience about how he personally, with his own eyes, had seen Johnny Goodboy Tyler walk on a cloud and, not only that, pull a demon out of it and sing a duet with him. When he had finished his story, he passed around a battered cup for offerings. It seemed he made his living this way. When he got to Johnny, Johnny pulled his mask down and Pierre nearly fainted again. There were so many exaggerations and lies going around about Johnny that he figured he didn't need another one. So he forced Pierre into a plane, took him right down to Africa, and made him get into another plane at Victoria and by himself fly it up to the peak where the cyclocadavers still lay in the snow, land, look, fly back down through the overcast, and land. Pierre made it without wrecking himself, and Johnny took him back to Luxembourg. Pierre said,
"Thank you."
And he meant it. He went back to his old job of moving the compound planes around the hangar, and in time became an acceptable pilot. There was a bizarre incident that occurred in Edinburgh. The sarcophagus of Biddy MacLeod had been miraculously preserved in the bombings. Three beams of the collapsing cathedral had fallen across it almost protectively. The Chatavarians had repositioned it in the new cathedral crypt in a row of dead war heroes, which included Glen Cannon's recovered remains. When she was 16, Patty demanded that she be taken to the crypt and married to Biddy MacLeod. Nothing could dissuade her, and she stood there beside the sarcophagus in a white wedding dress, holding Biddy's locket with "To My Future Wife" on it. The parson, who could find no law against it, went through the wedding ceremony. She then changed to widow's weeds, and after that called herself Mrs. Patty MacLeod. Still continuing with her medical training, she founded the MacLeod Intergalactic Health Organization. Johnny funded it, and it became a standard stop point on and off all firing platforms throughout the galaxies. It also provided instant medical service. Two other events had occurred. Johnny and Chrissy had a boy born to them, Timmy Brave Tyler, an absolute carbon copy of Johnny, as everybody swore. And 2 years later, they had a girl, Missy, that everyone affirmed was a mirror image of Chrissy. When Timmy was 6, Johnny blew up. Their boy was not getting properly educated. He had uncles by the absolute score. Uncle Colonel Ivan, Uncle Sir Robert, Uncle Dunnell Dean. And every Scot who had mined or served with Johnny was an uncle. They spoiled the child rotten. They brought him things from all over the world. But were they seeing to it that Timmy was properly educated? No. He did speak several languages after a fashion: Russian, Chinese, Chatavarian, Cyclo, and English. He could do sums in his head when it suited him, and he could drive a teleportation go-kart Angus and Tom Smiley had made for him. But Johnny was faced with the specter of a son who would grow up totally ignorant of the vital things in life. Johnny had made up his mind. Affairs were running fine, handled mostly by others anyway. So he took a few bare necessities, bundled Timmy and Chrissy and Missy and four horses into an old marine attack plane, and flew to southern Colorado. He disconnected the plane's phone and radio and hid the ship in a clump of trees and made camp. For the whole of the next year, rain or shine, Johnny worked on Timmy. Missy was fine, and she helped her mother very well, and learned all about real tanning and cooking and things like that. But it was Timmy who got the attention. At first, Johnny had it a little rough, for the boy obviously was getting a delayed start. But after a few months, he saw he was making real progress. The boy learned to track, to spot different animals and their immediate intentions. He learned to round up wild horses and train them, and he didn't need a sissy thing like a saddle. He came right along, and was quite cheerful about it. Johnny got him to throw kill clubs with considerable accuracy, and he even nailed a coyote with one. Johnny was just beginning to feel some security about the boy's future, and was about to post-graduate him into stalking wolves and then pumas. But on the very first day of this, he heard a plane in the afternoon sky. It wasn't a drone, it was a plane, heading for the plume of smoke that marked their current camp. Johnny and the boy trotted back, Johnny with uneasy forebodings. It was Dunnell Dean and Sir Robert. Timmy sprang at them like a small windstorm, shrieking glad shrieks of welcome.
"Uncle Dunnell Dean! Uncle Robert!"
Johnny's manners let Chrissy fix them some supper. They didn't seem to be in any hurry to get on with their business. Evening came, and the two of them and the family sat around the bonfire singing Scottish songs. Then Timmy showed them he hadn't forgotten the Highland fling, and danced it for them like Thor had taught him. Finally, when the children and Chrissy had gone to bed, Dunnell Dean made the wholly unnecessary statement,
"I suppose you're wondering why we're here."
"What's the bad news?" said Johnny.
"It isn't any bad news," grumped Sir Robert. "We've been holding 16 universes together like glue.
Why should there be any bad news?
It's been a year, said Donald Dean.
You came for something, said Johnny suspiciously.
Well, said Donald Dean, as a matter of fact, come to think of it, we did. A couple of years ago you made a tour of all the Earth tribes. It's been proposed that you make a tour of the major civilizations of the galaxies. A lot of governments want to bestow honors and estates and medals and things on you because galactic conditions are so prosperous.
It made Johnny very cross. I told you I was taking a year off. Don't you realize I have family responsibilities? What kind of father would I be to let my son grow up like an educated savage? He really let them have it. Donald Dean heard him out and then laughed.
We thought you'd say that, so we sent Thor instead.
Johnny studied that over. Then he said, So, if you handled it, why have you come? Sir Robert looked at him.
Your year is up, laddie. Doesn't it ever occur to you that your friends miss you?
So Johnny went back home, and while Timmy learned to speak 15 languages and do 5 kinds of math, while he learned to drive a ground car like Care and drive and fly anything the company made on any planet, including Dries Glotten's new yacht, his education was never finished. It was probably the one failure in Johnny Goodboy Tyler's life. Dr. McDermott, the historian who considered himself expendable, lived on and on. He wrote a book, The Johnny Goodboy Tyler I Knew, or The Conqueror of Cyclo, Pride of the Scottish Nation. It was not as good as this book, for it was intended for semi-literate people. But it had 3-dimensional pictures that moved in full color. He had access to several archives, and it sold 250 billion copies in its first printing. It was translated into 98,000 different galactic languages and went into many editions. Dr. McDermott received royalties so far in excess of anything his simple life needed that he endowed the Tyler Museum. It is the first building you see, the one with the golden dome, when you leave the McLeod Intergalactic Health Organization exit at the Denver terminal. Not too long after his return from America, Johnny disappeared. His family and friends were very concerned. But they knew that he disliked adulation and being unable to move about without attracting crowds. He had remarked that he was not needed now, and that he had done his work. A pouch, 2 kill clubs, and a knife were also missing. The dragon helmet and bright buttoned tunic were still there on a peg where he had last hung them. But people in the galaxies do not know that he is gone. If you ask almost anyone on a civilized planet where he is, you are likely to be told that he is there, just over that hill, waiting in case the lords or the cyclos come back. Try it. You'll see. They will even point. This concludes the reading of Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard. This book was read by Michael Rosato.